From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Edvard Munch's The Scream is up there amongst the most recognizable images of all time. The skull-like face, hands clasped to cheeks in anguish, horror, a swirling nightmare sky in the background. Today, The Scream, one of the four versions that Munch created, goes up for auction in New York. Big money expected. But what is it about this image that has so seared its way into our consciousness? This hour on Point, we're all about The Scream. You can join the conversation. What does The Scream say to you? Do you know that feeling? What is it? And would you hang it in your house? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. You can also check out our website for a gallery of different versions of The Scream from Munch and others. Joining me first today from Toronto is Don Thompson, professor of marketing and strategy at York University. He's an expert on art economics, author of The $12 Million Stuffed Shark, The Curious Economics of Contemporary Art. Don has just returned from New York City, where he's been following preparations for the auction of The Scream tonight. Don Thompson, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom.
$80 million, Sotheby's is saying, is kind of a ballpark for where things may begin. Does that make sense to you?
$80 million. It's very aggressive. Put that in context. Only four works have ever sold above $80 million at auction. Giacometti and a couple of Picassos. The previous record for Munch is $38 million a couple of years ago, and then the next one below that is much below it. So it's a long way. It's a lot of money.
We're going to talk all about the painting and the human condition that it depicts in this hour, but just to the business of this, who are potential buyers for a painting of $80 million? I mean, we're seeing people bandy around numbers as high as $150 million for The Scream.
Well, there's betting on it, and the betting is about 3-1 on $150 million.
Literal betting by bookies.
Literal betting. Well, you know, go back a step. There are three separate issues in this, all of them interesting. One is the artwork. It is one of the three most recognized art images in the world. Second is the promotion.
After or along with what? Mona Lisa, I suppose.
Mona Lisa is first. Now, think about this. Most of your listeners could tell you who painted Mona Lisa. Scream is second. And how many people could tell you who painted it? They are familiar with the image because it is it's iconic. It's been reproduced all over the place. The third image, curiously, is Che Guevara.
That's on T-shirts.
It's on T-shirts, and it's in posters in half the college dorms in America. And everyone recognizes it, but nobody knows who did it.
Does recognizability translate into high value in the upper echelons of art sales?
There are kind of three classes of auction-level art. There's good quality, and there's museum quality, and there's iconic. This is iconic. And iconic doesn't necessarily mean good. It means that people will go out of their way to view. Think of the Mona Lisa in the Louvre. 20,000 people a day visit the Louvre. Half of them only see the Mona Lisa and leave.
It's amazing. So who's on the shopping list for The Scream? I mean, who do they? They must have a pretty good idea. There aren't that many people in the world who could even think of it.
Or now this is not a picture you would hang in your bedroom. So. The speculation is on 10 collectors, two of whom are museums, the Getty in Los Angeles and the new museum in Qatar, which I guess is pronounced Qatar, which has been sopping up art. And you could add a third, the Louvre, the new Louvre in Abu Dhabi. Now, for each of those, it would be an iconic draw. It would make it a destination museum like the Louvre. And there are a few individuals, Ron Lauder, who's an American, Roman Abramovich.
Lauder, the cosmetics guy. Abramovich, what, that's a Russian industrialist?
He is a Russian industrialist. Philip Niarchos, who's a Greek shipping heir, and a few others, you know, but this is all speculation, because if you were going to bid on it, you wouldn't tell the news media. Or put that differently, if you were going to bid low and wanted to be seen as a player, you would tell news media, but if you were a serious bidder, you would not.
But Sotheby's has a pretty good idea. I mean, I think I've read, Don, they've been flying this pastel around the world so people can sort of check it out alongside their existing artworks. They flew it to Hong Kong and here and there.
They've taken it to the Middle East and to Europe and to Asia and to and had receptions and private viewings in New York and London, had a public viewing in London. That's not uncommon with artworks at this level. Many people don't want to travel to New York, but they may be interested.
You've said that if you're really wealthy, the painting above your mantle should match the price of your house. So that means if you've got an $80 million house, you might have an $80 million screen above the fireplace.
That's an old saying from the chief auctioneer at Sotheby's, and he said, you know, judge it. If you have a townhouse in the Upper East Side of New York, the painting above your mantle should equal the price of your townhouse. Now, that you have to stretch to think of an $80 million townhouse. Now, there's a 50-50 chance it's going to go over $100 million.
Okay.
You have an $80 million townhouse?
No, I have to really stretch to imagine
right.
that.
No, there's a 50-50 chance it'll go over. The record for any work at auction is $106.5 million. There's a 50-50 chance this will beat it, and there's maybe one chance in three it'll hit $150 million.
What was it that went for $106.5 million?
It was a Picasso called Nude, Green Leaves, and Bust, which sold 2 years ago.
So here we are. How's it going to work? Is it people sitting in the room scratching their ears, or is it all by telephone? How will the bidding work?
You will not see the winner in the room. Either they'll be bidding through an agent, or they'll be sitting in one of the private boxes and bidding from there, or they'll be on telephone.
Does the price at which a work of art tends to go relate to its sort of resonance in the moment of the sale? I mean, is the scream sort of meeting its moment here where there's a lot of concentrated wealth, but is it also an image that somehow resonates with our time? Does that drive the price up, Don?
It's hard to say. Every bidder has their own motive, and they may not be prepared to talk about it if you ask them. This is a lot of money. And for an individual, it is an extraordinarily expensive thing to have because you need protection and you need insurance, and that's expensive.
And this is its brothers and sisters. There are four versions of this have been stolen repeatedly. Don Thompson, you're terrific, and we're so grateful to you for giving us a kind of insider's view of what is going on in the speculation and preparation for the sale of the Scream. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Don Thompson, author of The $12 Million Stuffed Shark, expert on art economics. Joining me now from New York is Sue Prideau, author and art historian. She's author of Edvard Munch, The Behind the Scream. Sue, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with us from New York is Peter Sheldahl, acclaimed art critic for The New Yorker. His latest book is Let's See. He's written a lot on the cultural impact of the Scream. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Sue, first to you. What was going on with Edvard Munch when he painted The Scream?
Well, if you look at his life, he was hitting 30, incredibly unsuccessful as an artist, and at the end of a disastrous love affair, and he thought he could never love again. His heart was broken. There was insanity in the family, and all his life Munch was terrified that he would go insane. In fact, he never did. Mm. But his sister had just been committed to the madhouse. She had schizophrenia. And the Oslo madhouse was located in that Scream landscape. It's a place called Ekeberg, and it's on the bay of the Oslofjord. And you can look back at the city of Oslo, which you see in the painting. So it's a real landscape that he has located the figure in. And it was apparently a terrible place where you could hear the screams of the animals being slaughtered and the insane. And apparently it was a popular suicide spot.
Okay.
That was his kind of personal tragedy. And to put it in the generational context, he'd spent the previous year in Berlin with a bunch of intellectuals who were exploring what it was to be human 30 years after Darwin had published his theory of evolution. It was apparent that man was more than just a mere evolutionary result. What was he? What was the human soul?
Mm-hmm.
Was God really dead, as Nietzsche had written the previous year? So it asks a lot of questions.
Peter Sheldahl, what is it in this image, by your lights, you look at so much art, that just goes straight into everybody who sees it. You see it, you never forget it, and it resonates pretty much forever, in my experience.
Yeah, well, there's the nature of it as an image is against the nature of it as an object, which the original Scream is in the National Gallery in Oslo, in the Great Hall of the museum, along with almost all of Munch's other masterpieces. It's mm-hmm. one of the greatest rooms in the world. You know, that it has life for almost everybody in some form of reproduction. By the way, I regard the painting that's going on sale tonight as a reproduction, a handmade reproduction. It looks like, I've never seen it in person, it looks like a very good painting. But for me, the Scream is identical with the original fragile work on cardboard that hangs in Oslo. It is. There is really nothing like it. You know, it'd be interesting to try to winkle out some kind of kinship to the Mona Lisa. But it's an image, by the way, the précis we just heard of the formation of the occasion of the painting is great. Munch had painted other versions. It came, so he said, from an experience that he had in that location, and he had painted a couple paintings.
Peter, hold the thought if you'd be kind enough. We have to take a break right here, and I very much want to come right back to your thread there. An experience he had, an experience millions have had, maybe billions, in looking at this image. 800-423-8255 is our number. What hits you in the Scream? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Edvard Munch's iconic masterpiece of angst and alienation, The Scream. It has seared itself into our consciousness. It is up for sale, for auction, today. You can join the conversation this hour. Do you remember the first time you saw The Scream? What did it say to you? What does it say to you now? Do you know the feeling expressed by that anguished figure? Is that you sometimes? Is that E.T.? Is that all of us? Is that the human condition, the condition of nature? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We're joined today by Sue Prideaux. She's author, art historian, author of Edvard Munch, Behind the Scream. And also from New York by the great art critic Peter Sheldahl with The New Yorker. He's written a lot about the lasting cultural impact of Munch's The Scream. He's author of Let's See. He's got a new piece in the current issue of The New Yorker on the rise of art fairs. Check it out. But he's with us from New York. 800-423-8255 is our number. And Peter, I wish you'd just sit on the human condition as expressed in this image for a moment. What do you see when you gaze upon The Scream?
Well, I was going to approach it a little bit from Munch's biography. I mean, he had done a couple of versions of a figure hunched over the railing.
Of this bridge between Madhouse and Slaughterhouse.
As the two other figures walk away. And a sort of clenched, unspecified suffering. And then he's suddenly translated that into this wavering, homunculus, naked, emotionally naked, and, you know,
almost rhythm, fetal or a rhythm, skull.
Visual rhythms resonating with the landscape. By the way, I think a very important point of the painting is the two figures walking away. They don't hear the scream.
Well, I mean,
if it were audible, they would have spun around. It's entirely internal. And the experience of being, we all have our constant awkwardness of our inner lives, you know, conducted in the middle of our outer lives. And this is the extreme pitch of that. That's just a break. I think it's Sue's wonderful introduction. God is dead. It's to me, it's like a negative mystical experience. It's like as intense and specific as the religious raptures of, say, Saint Teresa, but it's an experience of absolute aloneness and absolute inconsolableness. And I know the feeling. If you ever get a chance to be in Oslo and see the original, it has a rawness to it, a physical rawness to it that is beyond words.
Sue, sit with us for a moment on the figure at the center of the scream, and you know, the Peter calls it a wavering homunculus. I mean,
yes.
This is not a fully formed human body exactly. It's kind of this representation. It's a little like E.T. or a skull or a fetus or something sort of half-formed and yet fully recognizable as human, and somehow all the more universally impactful because anyone can project on this. It's almost like an image of the soul, Sue.
You have that absolutely right. And earlier when Don was talking about icons, it's interesting because when you look at Che Guevara, I think you say, you're seeing something. You're seeing an image of an anarchist, a revolutionary.
Sure, and mustache, only, beard, a beret, the whole
all
works.
That, all that business, you know, you can imagine the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really only the section of the population who are probably of a certain age and a certain rebelliousness who identify with that. Mona Lisa, again, you're looking from the outside. You're looking at an icon of calm rationality of the Renaissance and an ideal of beauty. So you're looking from the outside again. But with the scream, because the scream has no age, no sex, we all have a skull.
Yeah.
Its body is not described. And so whatever age you are, whatever sex you are, if you're feeling anguished, and everyone has felt anguished, the scream is you. It's a mirror.
And you can write your own, to great depths straight upon it. Let's bring our listeners in. Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I just wonder whether anybody thinks that the figure in the painting is not screaming. I believe that from Munch's poem, in which he describes on the frame of one of the four versions that the scream is the scream of nature, that the figure in the painting is holding his or her ears shut and opening his or her mouth in a kind of gasp at the sound that figure alone is hearing. And I think the strange coloring of the sky is Munch's way of showing what this scream of nature represents in the mind of that figure at the center of the painting. The mouth itself is not configured in what we normally think of as a scream position. It would have to be much wider.
It's true.
It's open in a kind of gasp of horror as it closes its ears to the sound of the scream of nature. And I just wonder what your guests think of that.
We'll go straight to Alan. You're right on. It's true. It's a sort of vertical oval, not the wide mouth of scream. And the poem, as you call it, this is the version for sale tonight on which that is inscribed. I'm reading here that it was actually a page from a diary of Munch's that he presented here as a poem. And if I may, I would read it. Unless, Sue, you've got it right in front of you.
I've seen several versions of it in manuscript.
Would you like to read it for us just so we can get to
the
page?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. It says, I went along the road with two friends. The sun set. Suddenly the sky became blood, and I felt the breath of sadness. I stopped, leaning against the fence. Deathly tired. Clouds over the fjord dripped, reeking blood. My friends went on, but I just stood trembling with an open wound in my breast. I heard a huge, extraordinary scream pass through nature.
I've seen it translated as well as an infinite scream passing through nature. Peter, what is that?
I think that bears on what I said, it's a negative mystical experience. I mean, this isn't just the complaint of someone, you know, feeling lonesome. He does experience it as fundamental to existence. I mean, not just human existence. And it, you know, it approaches, I mean, you know, we can talk around and around it. It approaches something ineffable, which I think is why we keep coming back to it, because it's you can't use it up.
If I may, what's interesting to me here, Peter, I mean, we often talk about death as the great, but this is something almost bigger than death. This is almost a cosmic condition.
Well, just an absolute hostility of existence to human wishes, to how we wish things work, perhaps. I don't know. That's one set of words to throw at it.
Sue, what about you? The infinite scream through nature, passing through nature, what is that?
Well, if I can quote Munch's contemporary, Strindberg, the Swedish playwright, he did a critique of the scream when it was exhibited in Paris in 1896. And Strindberg wrote, "A scream of fear as nature, turning red with wrath, prepares to speak before the storm and thunder to the bewildered little creatures who, without resembling them in the least, imagine themselves gods, and I think that last thing, that last phrase, you know, the anguish of the human condition, we are possibly merely an evolutionary result. We imagine ourselves gods. Woo!
Oh, we scream, or we hear the scream.
Well, I mean, it's a moment when all of that breaks down. I mean, you know, when not only the sort of narcissism of being like God, but the hope that we're anything at all.
Yeah. We're a homunculus.
You know, and I think, you know, it's, I mean, here we are competing with Strindberg. I think he got it. He nailed it.
Let's go to Paul in Columbia, South Carolina. Paul, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, Krakatoa had just blown up about a year before he did that painting.
Half a world away in what's now Indonesia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the sunsets were blood red all over the world for several years, actually. And this may have just simply been his reaction to it. You know, this is not normal nature. This is something different. And what? So, you know, the mouth is not a scream, as you pointed out. It looks more like an expression of awe, wonder, fear, maybe, but not a scream.
Some sort of wide gasp from the soul. What about the Krakatoa? It had gone off. 1893, the first of these was painted. I think it was maybe sometime in the decade before that, and there were red skies for many years. There's speculation that maybe more than that Munk saw them. But there's also talk about his interest in Japanese art, and certainly there's that strong flavor here, Sue.
Absolutely. No, Krakatoa is certainly a, you know, well-accepted theory. And obviously the intensity of the color might easily have been added to by that. Japanese art, of course, if you look at the scream and you see it really particularly wonderfully in this pastel version that is on sale today, it is completely linear. The lines, yeah. it's a picture made up of lines.
So
straight
modern
ones.
In that way.
On the bridge, and beautiful curves. Mm-hmm. It just moves. The surface of the picture just moves like Japanese pictures do.
And that blue, almost a Japanese blue there. Gosh, let's our listeners have wisdom. Bill in New Haven, thanks for calling, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Way back when I was starting my doctoral dissertation in theater, I chose as my topic German Expressionism. And as I did my research, Edvard Munch's Germans call it Der Schrei, so I prefer even the stronger term, the shriek.
Mm-hmm.
But he really informed my work on German Expressionism, because what they did in the sets, lighting and costuming and so forth, was make it, as your authority said, from the inside. And it just really resonated. That's all I wanted, because I wrote some articles on his work for some of Ibsen's plays, and I share all of the comments, but he also resonated for those of us in the more three-dimensional world of a theater.
Yes. Bill, thank you for that. Peter Sheldahl, put this in context of where it stands in kind of the flow of genres. Impressionism was having its day. Munch didn't really go for it, and he was
late. I mean, he did some impressionists around 1889, he sort of zipped through Impressionism, Naturalism, into Symbolism. He's, you know, a tick after Gauguin and Van Gogh and Seurat. He was, I mean, like most geniuses, he was incredibly absorptive. I'm sure, you know, Krakatoa might have been in the picture, but you can't, there are more than enough answers to where he comes from. By the way, Sue made a great point about the linear quality of his painting. His whiplash kind of stroke, which feeds into Art Nouveau, and certainly into German Expressionism. But it's like to draw and paint in the same gesture was, I think, a keynote of his style. It is extraordinary and is still influential. And now I've forgotten your question.
No, that's fine. Well, I mean, I guess he's leaning toward forward into expressionism here. Not that all the words matter.
This is a moment of his absolute originality, but it has many elements. I mean, he, you know, as a Norwegian, you know, a marginal European, you know, he came a little late to all the movements. He had a feeling of being late. It made him, he was desperately ambitious, and voila.
Yeah, voila. Fred in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Fred, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, this is very difficult for me to express, but the fact that you're discussing a painting that seems to have many effects, many different effects on different people. I thought that the discussion and of what about the painting in regard to a recent death of my son, who took his own life, and circumstances and such that led up to his passing have been left for myself and my wife, particularly, with many, many questions, but also with images, particularly for myself, because I've seen many of the, I've seen photographs and whatever, but I've been trying to deal with images that your mind conjures on events such as death, and your people have spoken about death and blood and and all of that,
and the depth.
I'm just, yeah. The painting, we'll never know, perhaps what the artist was going through or what he was thinking. But I have an artist's son, and we were just discussing that very painting several days ago.
That your lost son may have felt something of that, or that you, or your wife, may feel it now, Fred.
Yes, that is exactly what I'm trying to say. My wife, who knows nothing of the things that I've seen surrounding my son's death, I've kept that from her. So I have in my mind every night for 31 days, I've had images of the person and what he went through, the agony and the desperation and the confusion and fear. And
oh, Fred, I'm so sorry.
I relate this. I think I relate this to this artist and this painting very much, very much so. And that's my personal expression of how I view that painting, because we have discussed it in more than a number of occasions, way before, you know, the suicide.
Fred,
but this has a lot of meaning to me.
I'm so grateful for you sharing that. That goes right to the depth of, I think, what's expressed here and maybe beyond. We wish healing and peace to your family, Fred. And if there's something universally human you find here that helps in that, then we're glad for it. Thank you for your call. Listeners, you can join us, 800-423-8255. We're talking about The Scream. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Edvard Munch's iconic masterpiece, Angst, Alienation, The Scream. It has seared itself into our consciousness. It is for sale today. You can join our conversation this hour. How do you put words to what this painting portrays, conveys? Are we all just that lost, despairing sometimes, all the time? Would you hang this baby over your mantelpiece in your living room? Where do you hope The Scream ends up, this scream? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. We're with Peter Seldahl, art critic for The New Yorker magazine, and Sue Prideaux, author, art historian, author of Edvard Munch Behind the Scream. Sue, Peter, if we may, I'd just like to sit with a minute with Fred's call. I mean, you know, talk about the depths of where art goes and where it takes our minds. He's dealing with about as difficult a moment as you can, and here's Munch playing into it, Peter.
Yes, it's sobering to be confronted with an actual tragedy, you know, that I certainly wouldn't comment on, except to say that my heart goes out. It's a somewhat similar experience. But it put me in mind that in fact, The Scream is about life. It's about the absolute fullness of life, as much as any Matisse, but in negative terms.
Explain that a bit more, if you would.
Well, I mean, the utter liveliness of the design of the paint.
True.
Of the touch.
Yes.
The intensity. It's a peak experience of life to which death might, for someone, be preferable.
Wow.
I don't know.
Yeah. Sue, your thoughts as you put yourself...
Well,
sympathetically toward Fred, and then the role of art here, as we, you know, it
yes.
is playing an important part, one way or another, in even
it
that moment in his family's life.
Yes, no, deepest sympathy to Fred. However, I think there is the word catharsis, mm-hmm. and I think that you know, with this horror does come the other side of the human condition. And can I just tell you a little anecdote?
Please.
The guy who is selling it today, Petter Olsen, obviously I know him, having written Munch's biography.
Yeah.
And Petter said that as a little boy, seeing The Scream hanging in his home, he loved it. He thought she was just a beautiful girl with long hair in front of a sunset.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow, a child's view. Now his father was a friend, patron, neighbor of Munch, I think. That's how this painting and many other Munchs came into the family.
Oh, it's the most amazing story, yes. Thomas was a neighbor and patron of Munch. And then, of course, when Hitler came to power in 1933, he was very anti what he called degenerate art, modern art,
including
Picasso,
Munch.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. And he confiscated this art from public museums and then from private collections. And Munch went to Thomas Olsen and he said, save my children, because they were either
paintings.
Going to be mm-hmm. sold or burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so Thomas bought various paintings, including The Scream, which he bought in 1937 in Stockholm, took it back to Oslo. Then what happens, of course, Hitler and the Nazis invade Norway. So then Thomas, very cleverly, before the invasion, he saw the writing on the wall, and he crated up his Munch paintings, and he trundled them up to the family farm, which is north of Oslo.
Mm-hmm.
And would you believe The Scream spent all of World War II in a crate in a hay barn under lots of hay? Isn't
wow.
it marvelous?
Was it all four copies or just this copy
in
particular?
No, just this one.
Amazing.
Just this one.
Amazing.
Just this one.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so now off it goes from the family. I wanted
That's
to ask
right.
you, I mean, there was the sort of family issues here, and then there was the cultural moment. On the family side first, I mean, Munch, I'm writing here, he said, talking about the instability that ran in his family, he wrote, "My father was temperamentally nervous and obsessively religious to the point of psychoneurosis. From him," Munch wrote, "I inherited the seeds of madness. The angels of fear, sorrow, and death stood by my side since the day I was born." There's the personal family story, and
exactly.
up against that, this moment, this sort of pre-Freudian moment you describe, Nietzsche, right, asking, is God dead? What's the balance you see here in this work?
Well, it's tremendous self-examination. I mean, before he went to Berlin and in 1893 painted The Scream, he had had an incredibly unsuccessful exhibition in Oslo when they just laughed and mocked him and said of one canvas, The Sick Child, there's not a picture on the canvas. It's just a soiled sheet hanging out on a washing line to dry. Okay. They couldn't see it was a picture. And then, would you believe it, I mean, poor man, there was a public debate on Munch's sanity and he hid behind a curtain to hear it. In fact, the insanity in the family was just his paternal grandfather had died insane, but that was only the last symptoms of tuberculosis of the spine. It wasn't a mental problem. Okay. But his sister Laura, who became schizophrenic, that was a mental problem. So Munch took upon himself the anxiety that he might have insanity inside himself, but he didn't.
Peter, you put this in the context of so much going on around it. I mean, Kierkegaard talking about anxiety and the dizziness of freedom. Everybody at the late end of the 19th century grappling with the advent of modernity. Take us to those points, Peter.
Well, it's the great cosmopolitan efflorescence. You know, the height of Paris as not only a destination but a symbol of free, liberated life, and Munch dove into that. I mean, as Sue makes clear, he had every reason to get the hell out of Oslo, which was not even Oslo yet. It was Christiania. It was Swedish. He embraces that freedom and tells some unwelcome news about it.
That it also brings a dizziness, which sounds like a light word for a deep unsettling.
Yeah, vertigo. I mean, mm-hmm. and just free fall. He didn't help matters by his habits. Drank a lot. And he said at one point, he wanted to be the medium through which today's thoughts and feelings flow. He saw himself as a medium, as a channel, as a conduit, and through in the 1890s, he certainly was.
And you speak of him in this image, The Scream, channeling that central existential condition of modernity. Elaborate on that.
Well, modernity being the occasion, being the specific, the proximate cause. I think there's a sense that it resonates not only in its time, but forward and back. Again, it would be interesting for some theologically trained person to relate it to the tradition of mystical writing.
Sue, that puts it in a very kind of deep and grand context, and it belongs there. But at the same time, one of the interesting things about this painting is that it has been parodied so often again. Andrea writes to us on our website. She says, I don't want to trivialize the darkness of this painting or the comfort or that provides for anyone suffering, but it's also been an important source for countless parodies that bring much-needed levity or pressure valve to the stress of being alive. How's it working that way, Sue? What's going on? Because we all know that it was a punching bag and a coffee mug and a Homer Simpson parody. I mean, what is it about this painting that can go to our deepest fear and anxiety but also give us a great laugh?
Absolutely. When I started writing the book, I thought that I would collect Scream cartoons, and I got two boxes and I gave up. We laugh at things we're afraid of, don't we? There is always that element in humor. It can be adapted to anything. I don't really have a good answer to this, you know.
it's amazing. There's so much, so many.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, the relief of laughter is human. It's very American. I think, in a way, you know, a parallel which may seem far-fetched would be Mel Brooks's The Producers.
Springtime for Hitler in Germany.
Yeah, springtime for Hitler. I mean, it's like, you know, like bracketing the worst possible thing in a comic vein is like, it's a shock. I mean, I remember my laughter at the first time at the producers. It was like, you have to turn me inside out. But again, it's the image of the scream, I mean, it's like an essence of over-the-topness, you know, which is why I immediately insisted on the original scream in Oslo, which, when you're looking at it with his hand, his inventing, discovering hand, in this terribly fragile picture, you know, that there is no possible laughter. It's not funny at all. No,
viscerally terrifying, and yet we've got decades of yucks, both.
But again, there is a life in it that, you know, the kids, actually I talked to Norwegians I know, said they were brought up thinking, poor Edvard. You know, he was like, they felt very sad for him. They wanted to give him a hug.
Sarah writes to us online, it shows outwardly the suppressed urges we all carry. Very visceral. Bonnie says, ever since this painting's image was ripped off for the Scary series of movies, not to mention those ubiquitous Halloween masks every year, that's all she can think of. Lewis in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Lewis, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The main thing that when I see the screen, the painting, I don't see it as an instantaneous scream of despair. I have had in my life many instances that I could have reflected the anguish and the anxiety that the painting reflects. So I don't see it something as instantaneous. It's an ongoing experience in life for me.
Lewis, I don't think you're alone in that, but not just of a moment, but kind of an unending condition. I think we can relate to that. I appreciate your call. If I may, let me get one more from London, Kentucky. Carol is calling. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. I first saw the scream after I had seen a picture of a lynching in the South of three black men with about 100 white people standing underneath it, men laughing, women looking self-righteously holy. And then I saw the scream, and to me, the scream was a wail, a historical universal wail of no, of outrage, of, I think that's
outrage against injustice, and you could certainly see it that way. Though there's something in all of nature, but maybe at the most unjust moment, it resonates the most. Carol, thank you for that. And if I may, one more, Karen in Newtown, Connecticut. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show. My comment can be really quick. My daughter, when she was a student about 2 years ago at the intermediate school here in Newtown, did an art project featuring the scream with the figure screaming into a cell phone. She called it cell phone scream.
How old was she?
And she was 10. And I said to her, is he screaming so he can be heard on the cell phone, or is he screaming because he has to be on a cell phone, or why is he screaming? And she said, it's really all of that, isn't it? And I thought, wow. First I thought, of course, she's really talented. And then I also thought, this image just transcends generations and transcends, you know, the technology of the times, and it just must be very universal for a 10-year-old to see this and see a modern application.
Even a 10-year-old, that is one cell phone talker I don't want to be next to on the train. But, well, there's a range right there. Peter Sue, I mean, Lewis was saying, look, this isn't a one-time thing. There's a lifetime of this that he recognizes. And Carol, who responds to it in the context of a lynching and injustice, outrage, and then a 10-year-old, Peter, that's quite an arc for one.
Yeah.
So what about the historical responses to this over time, the range of ways people have responded? It's been a century and more now.
It has indeed. And immediately, he made it. It really hit the zeitgeist of the generation, and so he made a lithograph of it, which was very popular. Though it didn't sell much, unfortunately. It didn't get him much money. It was widely reproduced and widely accepted as an expression of the generation. But again, it's quite interesting. When I wrote my book, one of the questions I would ask people was, when do you think Munch painted The Scream? And 9 out of 10 would associate it with either World War I or World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And would be astonished when I said it was that much earlier.
From almost the Belle Epoque here, you've got the the Scream, and yet it looks like just the opposite of that. We've got.
Well, he went to Paris, you know, but he couldn't make any headway there. That's why he ended up in Germany.
Our listener John writes to us, I hope a museum buys it or a private collector who will loan it to museums frequently. It would be a shame, John writes, if it goes to some twit like the guy who bought the Picasso and put his elbow through it. Yes, we hope it doesn't end up in a vault somewhere buried underground. What do you think, Peter? What are the odds? We'll get to see this one forever.
It's a peculiarity of Munch's reputation that through the events of the Second World War, almost all of his great paintings ended up in the same room in Oslo. I think there's only one great Munch in America, the Voice in Boston. We know it by reproduction, and we'll unfortunately continue to know it that way.
Nietzsche said God is dead. Freud would come along and put a lot of meat on the bones of this. Here's Edvard Munch with The Scream. And after all these years, the world's still paying close attention with all kinds of responses in the human condition, writing right beneath. Peter Sheldahl with The New Yorker, author of Let's See, Writings on Art from The New Yorker. Peter, thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
And Sue Prideaux, author of Edvard Munch, Behind the Scream. It's been wonderful to have you. Thank you so much, Sue.
Thank you, Tom. It's been lovely to be here.
Listeners, thanks for all you bring. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.